speak tonight for the dignity of man and the destiny of democracy.
May the turbulence of our age yield to the true time of peace, when men and nations shall share a life that honors the dignity of each, the brotherhood of all.
I see a world of open borders, open trade, and most importantly, open mind.
Hello and welcome to the Republic, a show dedicated to history, civics, and U.S. institutions. I'm your host, Jake. And in this month's episode, we are going to be discussing what the heck is going on in Ukraine. Before we get started on the quagmire that is U.S. foreign policy in the Ukraine and how that relates to Russian expansion and all of that, I do want to give a shout out to the station that makes this show possible, and that's KXRW. KXRW is an amazing platform. It helps give the local voices of the Greater Vancouver area and the Portland area a voice, and a much needed voice. And if you enjoy what we're doing as much as I enjoy what I'm doing, please consider donating. It keeps us on the air, and it's the lifeblood of our mission. And we need our listeners. And so if you can go to kxrw.fm, there's a donate tab right there. You can sign up to be a monthly subscriber, part of our membership package with monthly donations. Anything helps, and it helps keep us on the air, and it helps keep Vancouver's voice heard. So with that, I think we'll start on our topic for this month. And like I said, we'll be discussing America's role in the Ukraine and how America has gotten to the point where it's needing to be the major face in against Russian expansion in Eastern Europe. So, because it seems like, you know, 100 years ago, what was happening in Eastern Europe was not in any way the something that the United States would even consider getting itself involved in. And now it seems like it's a foregone conclusion that the United States has a very vested interest in what happens with Russian annexation and Russian expansion in the Eastern European states. Even though Ukraine is not a member of NATO, so there isn't a treaty obligation for the United States to care about the sovereignty of the Ukraine, but yet multiple presidencies has acted as, you know, have been acting as this is a major litmus test for American power, and that we need to at all costs prevent Russian expansion into the sovereignty of other nations. So what changed? How did that change? And is that change something important? One particular Fox News host seems to think that it's not. And I think I'm going to try to prove that what happens in Ukraine is a, especially going forward in the present time, is a major issue, and it's something that needs U.S. attention. So let's buckle up and let's take a dive into NATO. So why I feel like we need to start with the history of NATO is because it's at the heart of what's going on right now in Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin is adamant that he does not want a NATO-backed country on its border. That is his stated reason for staging a defensive posture on Ukrainian border. The United States and other Western and its Western allies are very skeptical of that, since back in 2015, Russia had already annexed the Crimea, which is a highly contested area historically between Russia and other countries and other empires. There's been wars fought in the Crimea. There was the famous Crimean War in the 1850s, 1860s, that led to multiple empires clashing. The Ottoman Empire, the British, the French all fought there. So it's in the Russians. So it's that's been an area that's changed hands significantly over time, and Russia claims it's that territory, but it was Ukrainian sovereign within the sovereign border of Ukraine in 2015, and when Russia annexed that. And so the concern here is that Russia is going to continue its push into Ukraine because it was a subjugated country under the Soviet Union. And it's because it's not a NATO country, there isn't necessarily a treaty responsibility by the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, to come to its defense. And we'll get into we'll get into the collective defense agreement between NATO and member states here in a bit, but I think starting with the history of NATO and how why it was created is, I mean, the reason is kind of the reason why, or at least the foundation to kind of how we got here right now, and why Russia is in such opposition to NATO expansion, and why that's been a thorn in Russian side, and why they may be why they're so hesitant, and why they see it as their national security to not want NATO to expand closer to its borders. I'm just playing devil's advocate here because I feel like, to be fair, I need to look at things from an objective stance in terms of how both sides may see this. And then we'll get into whether that's a legitimate concern or not later. But so the history of NATO. So in 1947, so right after the end of World War II, the Treaty of Dunkirk was signed by France and the United Kingdom as a treaty alliance of mutual assistance to in the event of a possible attack by either Germany or the Soviet Union in the aftermath of World War II. And then in 1948, this alliance was expanded to include the countries in the western area, such as Belgium and Denmark. The Treaty of Brussels was signed then in 1949, and then leading to the North Atlantic Treaty in 1949, which expanded membership of the Western Union, which was those countries I just mentioned, to include the United States, Canada, Portugal, Italy, Norway, Denmark, and Iceland, forming the original 12 members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. The actual North Atlantic Treaty became largely dormant until the Korean War initiated the establishment of NATO. Really, the Korean War is what propelled NATO into a real organization. And when I think the key part to the key word here in North Atlantic Treaty Organization and that acronym NATO is organization. And what that means is that NATO exists above its member states. Instead of just being a treaty of countries that just come together and then make a decision, there actually is a headquarters for NATO. There are people who work for NATO that are not employees of their home country. They are employees of the organization NATO. And yes, NATO is very much an extension and controlled by its member states. There is a component of NATO that exists above the states and can make day-to-day decisions in implementation of the policies that its member states come to. And there are now 30 members of NATO. NATO really took an anti-communist stance as it went through the Cold War. It became very much a anti-Soviet or a response to Soviet expansion. NATO became the counterweight to the Soviet Union, which was the Iron Curtain, everything from East Germany east. NATO was very much instrumental to keeping communist and Russian expansion in the post-World War II era, and was instrumental in eventually the collapse of the Soviet Union. And once the Soviet Union collapsed, a lot of those states, a lot of the countries that were part of the Soviet Union have now become NATO member states, which has greatly angered Russia. For example, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, which are right on the Russian border, are key member states in NATO. Poland, Romania, Hungary, Bulgaria, all of these countries are now part of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. There's actually more member states than not in Eastern or in Eastern Europe. And that concerns Russia, since NATO's stated goal, or original stated goal, was to stop Soviet Russian expansion. So it's, by definition, or at least its original definition, was to be anti-Russian. So Russia is going to see NATO as a potential threat. So you can see why Russia is concerned about NATO expansion and doesn't see NATO expansion in its own interest, and it actually sees it as adversarial. And it doesn't want Ukraine, which is one, the probably the largest country on its border in Europe, to become a NATO member state. That's its stated reason for its current troop buildup on the border. So what does this have to do with the United States? And you know, I think that's an interesting question. And why does the United States feel that it needs to be at the forefront of this? I think the answer there lies with its treaty obligations, but also because the United States, since the end of the World War II era, has been the world, or at least since the, well, since the end of World War II, it has been one of the two major dominant powers shaping international politics. The United States' goal coming out of World War II is to make sure a World War II never happened again. And economists and sociologists and political scientists and politicians from all over the world came together and formed the structure of what would become this kind of the world order that we see today. All of these institutions based on, you have the major political institution of the United Nations, you have economic, finance institutions in the World Trade Organization, dealing with trade, banking, and economics, finance, the WTO, like I said, the World Trade Organization, the World Bank Group, the International Monetary Fund. All of these were created to alleviate the tensions that were identified as major causes for international war between countries, to help alleviate and find more cost-effective mechanisms to address the issues that cause states to go to war with each other. So you can go to, if you have a trade dispute with another nation, instead of going to war, like humans have for all of its existence, you can go to the World Trade Organization, pitch your complaint, and there is a mechanism within NATO, within the World Trade Organization, that can punish or uphold and certain violations. They can make rulings and try to change the behavior of states so that states don't feel like they have to go to war to protect everyone of its self-interest. It's not everyone for itself anymore necessarily. It is a more collective international society trying to bring some sort of order to the chaos that is international politics of 200 plus sovereign nation states. We can argue all day whether that is that's been successful, but that was the goal and the mindset of the United States coming out of World War II. And NATO, in a way, is an extension of that, where the United States kind of took the forefront of, with the Marshall Plan, the Truman Doctrine, to try to stop Soviet communist expansion, seeing that as the greatest threat to American sovereignty and American interests abroad, was to stop communism. And NATO, which, as we saw, was not created by the United States, but the United States joining now through over the decades quickly became the largest military donor. And the way that the structure of NATO works is that there's two components to it. There's the civilian component and there's the military component. So all member states have military that they have ready for the collective defense of the NATO bloc. So they do joint exercises. There's also the civilian arm of NATO, which helps implement stuff like cybersecurity and organizing the meetings and the understandings and stuff like that. The more political side of NATO, trying to get all the nation states on the same on the same plane, because NATO, when NATO makes a decision, it can only make a decision based on consensus. So all 30 members have to vote in favor of it, otherwise it doesn't act. The policy isn't implemented, so it has to be unanimous. But the United States consistently is by far the biggest contributor to the military side and also the civilian side. And the United States controls, is when NATO was set up, the military side of NATO is controlled by the United States. So like the chief military commander is an American general. And the civilian side is a European. So there's kind of like the split between the Europeans and the Americans in terms of the NATO structure. But the United States has a very much a vested interest, and it is the face of NATO militarily. So that is why the United States, I think in large part, why the United States has such a vested interest in maintaining nation state sovereignty, in maintaining military presence in Europe. The way the post-war structure set up is that it upholds nation state sovereignty as paramount. It is the bedrock of international norms and international values, is that the borders of a state should only be violated under very specific and defined circumstances. And it should, in any violation of a nation state sovereignty is seen as a crime. Now, we can argue whether the United States has been also one of the worst violators of this. I think that's, there's fair historical precedent to make that argument. However, we're talking in realist politics, and in today, there is a Russian threat to invade the sovereignty of the Ukraine, and the United States is responding to that. And I think that kind of brings us up a little bit to where we are today, and I think on the other side of our break, we will tackle that a bit. So with that, we're going to take a break and hear from our sponsors. You are listening to the Republic. We will be right back.
KXRW would like to thank Craft Cannabis, our exclusive cannabis sponsor, for supporting our radio community. Craft Cannabis for 21 and over now has two locations in Vancouver. The newest shop is on Andreessen Road off Patton Parkway, next to Home Depot. At this location, they offer Top Shelf Tuesday, Waxy Wednesday, and Stony Sunday specials. The Mill Plain location is in the Heights Shopping Center with Munchy Monday and Shatterday specials. Ordering options include online, in-person, curbside, and express window touchless pickups to better serve you. Hours and more information available at craftcannabis.com.
Community radio like this is brought to you by the generous support by our founding sponsors at ADCO Commercial Printing and Graphics, Clark County's local print shop since 1993. ADCO features stationery, posters, flyers, tickets, business cards, stickers, catalogs, and much more. Print on anything and mail anywhere. Learn more at ADCO1.com. That's ADCO, the number 1.com.
Welcome back to the Republic. I am Jake, and in this month's episode, we are talking about the situation in Ukraine from a historical perspective, specifically looking at the history of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, America's role, the United States' role in that organization, and why the post-war era, Soviet tensions during the Cold War, NATO being constructed as a kind of a tool to stop that expansion as a counterweight to Russian aggression in the immediate post-war era. American foreign policy and anti-communist sentiment has really led us to Ukraine, a former Soviet Union country, has been independent or not independent under Russian rule for a long time, has suffered a lot under Russian rule, especially under the Tsarist regimes and under Soviet rule, especially under Stalin. So there's a major fear of Ukraine falling back under Russian rule. And what obligation, both treaty wise, but also a moral obligation, an obligation to the values that the United States has tried to promote internationally through the creation of the post-war organizations that we talked about briefly in the first segment, the UN especially, trying to uphold the sovereignty of nation states as paramount to world stability. And without, if that norm is violated, there needs to be repercussions, is kind of how the United States has viewed its foreign policy and its goals more broadly. You see that with the defense of South Korea during the Korean War, the defense of South Vietnam. I mean, those were the stated goals, right? We can argue all day whether that was the reality of it all, but that is the stated goal of the United States. So here, the stated goal of the United States is to protect the sovereignty of Ukraine from an expansionist Russia. And I guess the question really becomes, will the United States actually go to war with Russia to protect the Ukraine? Now, the Ukraine is not a member of NATO. NATO has the thing that gives NATO one of its biggest, what makes NATO such a heavyweight, I should say, is that it is under Article 5 of the NATO Charter. And that is an attack, basically it boils down to an attack on one is an attack on all. So if a member state is any member, one of the 30 members of NATO, now is what the membership currently stands at, is attacked by an external force, all member states will come to the defense of that state, of that country. And the only time that Article 5 has ever been invoked was actually after 9/11, when the United States was attacked by terror forces. And NATO, up until the end of our time in Afghanistan in September of 2021, NATO countries had a significant presence in the country. Even though it was spearheaded and mostly was the United States, NATO had a very significant and important presence in the operations in Afghanistan for 20 plus years. So as far as how does this relate to the Ukraine? If it's not a nation state, why does the United States feel like it needs to protect it other than some idea of moral obligation? And the Ukraine has tried to enter NATO, and the Ukraine has seen that its own self-interests is best for its own independence is tied to joining NATO. But because of that attack on one is an attack on all threat, like treaty obligation comes with it concerns by other nation states. NATO does not want to admit a country that has border disputes. That's one of the minimum thresholds for gaining entrance into NATO. You can't have a disputed border. Well, why would that be? If you have a disputed border, war or some sort of conflict is likely. So that could trigger a quagmire, that could trigger Article 5, technically, forcing other states to go to war. So having a disputed border does not allow, it pretty much is a no-go for joining NATO. And because the Ukraine, since 2015, has had a disputed border with Russia over the Crimea region, and also other regions in the Ukraine, especially since Belarus to its north is not a NATO member and allied with Russia. There has been constant excursions of Russian separatists. There's also Russian nationals who live in Ukraine who want Ukraine, or at least the area that they live in, returned to Russia. So there is a lot of territorial disputes in Ukraine between ethnic Russians, ethnic Ukrainians, and the states and governments of both Russia and Ukraine. So there is a lot there Ukraine would need to solve before it became a member state of NATO. Secondly, you have to have relative political stability and real anti-corruption mechanisms in place and be a fairly anti-corrupt government. There's arguments saying that, well, there are other countries that are dealing with a lot of the same things. Hungary, for one, is dealing with a lot of political upheaval right now in its country, especially with Viktor Orban and his ties to Russia and how free their politics really are and how free their elections really are. But Hungary is already a member state before all of that happened. So that gets into questions of expulsion from NATO. My point is that all of this is very tricky, and there really is no easy answer. But Ukraine has well-documented corruption in its government, especially from the energy sector and the oil sector. And you know that got brought up with the whole Biden email, the Hunter Biden email scandals. All of that was ancillary in internal American politics. But there is a history of corruption in Ukraine, especially stemming from the energy sector, and how that influences politics internally. I know that the current president in Ukraine is trying to clean that up, but it is not to the point where NATO, would consider letting Ukraine join its military or its collective defense alliance. You can blame Russia for a lot of that. Russia is constantly meddling in Ukrainian elections. Russia has consistently meddled in a lot of countries' elections, even ours. And you can blame them specifically for the territorial disputes in Ukraine. So I find it odd that their stated goal is to keep, the reason why they're building up this mass, their stated reason for building up a massive troop, massive amount of troops on the Ukrainian border is to keep, is if Ukraine becomes a NATO member, that the Russia is protected from like an attack into its country. But all of its previous actions has kept and will continue to keep Ukraine out of NATO. So I don't really buy Russia's stated goal of we're only putting troops on the Ukrainian border right now as a reaction to NATO expansion. Well, NATO has already expanded in the 90s when it allowed, for decades now, NATO has expanded into countries on the Russian border. So why now? Why Ukraine? And I think that is a question that all foreign policy experts are trying to identify. Why is Russia doing this right now, and what is their goals? What does Vladimir Putin want? And is the prospects of war in Ukraine credible? And what then does the United States and its Western allies do should Russian troops invade the sovereignty of Ukraine? So to answer that question, I think we have to look historically. And so when has NATO used military action in other countries? So when has NATO forces deployed for military purposes? And the first instance is in Korea, when you have many NATO member states contributing its militaries to the Korean Peninsula on a kind of a joint exercise with UN. So the UN sanctioned a military action in Korea, and then NATO was kind of like the military arm of the UN, because the UN doesn't really, outside of its peacekeeping force, which really isn't much of a military intervention force, as seen by its failures in Rwanda and other places. I shouldn't be so critical in UN peacekeeping missions. They're there as a report, as like more of a reporting and reconnaissance style force than they are like a military prevention force. So they get deployed in areas that are hot or going to be hot, and they kind of report back to the UN and try to do what protecting they can when they can, but they're not really a force that has a lot of teeth behind it. Whereas NATO is full on military, armor, air, sea, boots on the ground, with fully trained, full-time military personnel. And all 30 members will either send troops or they will send supplies, but all members, when Article 5 is invoked, will send military assets or military equipment to help out the effort wherever it may be. So in Korea, the NATO has acted as kind of a quasi-military arm of NATO, and that also of the UN, and that also happened in the breakup of Yugoslavia in 1992 and 1995, and then also later 1999. So with like the first Yugoslavian breakup and the conflicts that followed in Bosnia and Croatia and Yugoslavia and the genocides that occurred there, the UN couldn't act with its peacekeeping arm in a lot of ways, because the way UN also works, similar to NATO, in at least at its the Permanent Security Council membership, is that if there's a veto amongst any of the five Permanent Security Council members on the UN, at the UN, it cannot act. And Russia during the Korean War was boycotting the UN, so their seat was vacant. And at that time, the Chinese seat on the Security Council was actually occupied by Taiwan and the former nationalist government, which had been expelled from China mainland under Mao Zedong's Communist Party. And so the United States was still recognizing, and especially at the international level, was giving China's seat on the Security Council to Taiwan, which was Western-backed and Western-allied. So the UN was able to pass a security resolution to permit use of force in Korea. It couldn't do that in the breakup of Yugoslavia because the Russians backed, vetoed any sort of military action. So as a kind of workaround, the Western members of the Security Council, the UK, France, and the United States, which are the three biggest players within NATO, used kind of NATO as a quasi-UN. The UN is like, we want this to happen, but we can't necessarily have it happen through proper channels. So where else can we get an international force to do the things that we want? There is NATO. And so NATO kind of, we could argue, acted outside of its bounds in the Baltic states during the Yugoslavian breakup in the mid-90s. We don't need to get into that conflict too much, but it really did bring a lot of change about in how NATO structured its military. NATO, after the Yugoslavian breakup and NATO's involvement in that, it created a rapid response force. So there is at all times a force of international troops and planes and basically an entire expeditionary force ready to go at any time at a moment's notice to respond to threats. And I think the involvement in the Yugoslavian civil war and revolutions really shows that NATO, especially in the post-World War II era, as the United States became more involved in regional or in local conflicts, so did NATO. And I think that it shows that the United States and NATO will involve themselves in non-member state actions or things that are happening that it sees as a direct or indirect threat to their own security. So NATO believed that a power vacuum in the Baltics could lead to more Russian influence. It believed that it could lead to more political instability, and therefore saw its interests tied directly to the preservation of those nation states, or at least to stop humanitarian crises from happening. So NATO under that in the mid-90s really changes its focus from strictly an anti-Soviet response to a more broad scope of its seen duties, and really changing how NATO sees itself both structurally and at the nation state level. So what does that have to do with the Ukraine today? Well, using the case in the cases of the Yugoslavian breakup and the changes that NATO went under in response to that, you could make a argument that NATO and the United States would would go to war over with Russia over a non-member state to uphold sovereignty, to keep a humanitarian crisis from happening. That's a definitely a valid argument. And there are people within the international relations foreign policy community who do believe that that is the case, that war is imminent. If Russia chooses to violate the sovereignty of Ukraine, the United States both has precedent and a moral obligation to uphold Ukrainian sovereignty. There are others who believe that the United States will not go to war with Ukraine and is doing all it can to try to deter Russian expansion in other ways through threats, through of threats of military action, even if they are just bluffs, or possible sanctions if Russia does act, using the international community through its other institutions, such as the World Trade Organization, to place trade embargoes on Russia, using the UN to formally condemn Russia, other things like that to punish Russia in ways that make Russian expansion and invasion of Ukraine so expensive that it's not worth it. And I think that is probably where, in my opinion, the truth kind of lies. And we'll get into that on the other side of the break, is what are the real true prospects of war between the United States / NATO and Russia in the Ukraine. And with that, I think we're going to take a break and hear from our sponsors. You've been listening to The Republic. I'm Jake, and we'll be right back.
Domestic violence is not okay, and it's on the rise, especially now during this time of COVID-19. Domestic violence comes in many forms, such as physical abuse, verbal, financial, sexual, stalking, and technological abuses. If you or someone you know is in an abusive relationship, we can help. The Vancouver Police Department and the YWCA are here for you. You are not alone, even in this time of crisis. You can call the YWCA at 360-695-0501 or call 911 for the police. You can also find helpful information about the Safe Choice Domestic Violence Program at ywcaclarkcounty.org and in Portland at ywcapdx.org.
A big thank you to Vancouver's own Kagan's Theater for supporting our radio community. Our historic Kagan's Theater has a long tradition of showing movies for our community, 85 years. Kagan's currently features first-run big studio and art house films along with classic movie revival. Check out their live events, and you can even book the theater for a private party or public event. Go to kagansthéâtre.com to see how you can rediscover the joy of going out for movie night again. Showtimes, booking information, and more at kagansthéâtre.com.
Welcome back to The Republic. I am your host, Jake, and in our last segment, we talked about the history of NATO and how that might lead to prospects with war between the United States and its NATO allies and Russia over Ukraine. We talked about the past precedents for what the U.S. that might indicate to us why the United States would go to war, using the case of the Yugoslavian breakup in the mid-90s and NATO actions there, and other humanitarian / sovereignty intervention in terms of the Korean War and the Vietnam War, where NATO forces were present. Now I think we're going to focus in this segment on really kind of digging into what are the legitimate prospects of war between the United States and Russia over the Ukraine. Does Russia intend to invade? Would the United States, if it does come to the defense of Ukraine with actual military assets, going to war with Russia? A war that the United States and Russia were able to completely avoid during the Cold War when both superpowers were at its height. And it would be absolutely catastrophic if a war broke out, which is why I believe that war will not happen between the United States and Russia, even if Russia does invade. But it would be a monumental foreign policy failure of the current administration should Russia invade Ukraine, because I think that shows that U.S. deterrence is no longer enough to keep states in line in terms of not violating norms, and especially invading the sovereignty of another nation, especially a nation like Ukraine, which is more stable than say Russia's involvement in Syria, which was already involved in a, like devolved into a civil war. So it's not really apples to apples to compare, I think, some of the stuff that's going on in the Middle East with what's going on in Ukraine. But there are definitely parallels and arguments you can make there that would say, well, why didn't the United States go to war with Russia over Syria, and then but would go to war with Russia over Ukraine? And I think that there is enough differences there that when you weigh cost benefits, there is... you can kind of come up with a reason why, looking at self-interests and the in not wanting to go to war. Because I don't think either side wants to go to war. We're talking about war between two nuclear-armed countries. And once war starts, once that Pandora box is open, all is fair in love and war. Anything could happen. And I think trying to prevent that is a must. And trying to deter Russia from invading Ukraine at all costs is paramount to U.S. security and U.S. interest going forward. And I'm going to try to explain why. I feel that the reason why the United States needs to deter Russia from invading Ukraine, other than the obvious that Ukraine deserves to be a free, independently run country. Ukraine has suffered significantly under Russian rule for centuries, under the Tsarist regime. They were forced into essentially slave labor under the serfdom. Under the serfdom system, and then under Stalinist Russia, arguably even worse, or just a continuation of the atrocities committed by the Russians on the Ukrainians during the communist takeover of Ukraine. We uphold, especially in modern times, the sovereignty of nation states, and Ukraine deserves to be a free country. But in terms of looking at this as a national interest for the United States, why does the United States have a vested interest in maintaining Ukrainian sovereignty? And I think it's because even though Ukraine is not a NATO member, and we discussed why and how and why that's important in the previous segments, but the United States has built its reputation, it's built its deterrence, and it's built the norms that kind of govern the international structure the United States basically developed in its image after World War II, holding up nation state sovereignty. And if it fails to be able to uphold sovereignty in this case, I think it really erodes U.S. influence abroad. And I feel like that is something that is worth maintaining. And I think one of the major issues here is that I don't think the United States would intend to actually go to war with Russia over Ukraine. It's both internally. I don't think the United States, coming out of, especially we just got out of Afghanistan, I don't think the American populace wants to continue war. We're a war weary society, and getting into a quagmire in Eastern Europe with Russia is not something I think the United States has any interest in getting in, both with public opinion and also just with our resources in the political turmoil we're in right now. It is not something that we want to get into, but we do need to deter it. And I think that Russia understands that here's the trick for Biden and his foreign policy. This is why foreign policy is so difficult, is you don't know intentions. You don't know what Vladimir Putin really intends to do. And I think that is one of the benefits of a more closed off political system like dictatorships have, that your internal politics, the internal infighting between people within your government isn't broadcasted on nightly news. So your intentions can be kept a little bit more quiet and unknown. Whereas in the United States, I think pretty much in a lot of ways, the world kind of knows how America feels about certain things and how America is going to react to public opinion. Obviously, the president has a lot of autonomy in how it acts internationally, but the president is still very much tied to public opinion. And public opinion and, you know, having checks and balances within our system and how all of that plays out openly. Democracies are a very much more open political system, which therefore intentions are a little bit more easy to gauge, which why relationships and alliances between democratic countries are usually much stronger and long-lasting than they are between prior to democratic reforms in Europe and democratic reforms abroad. The old empires didn't get along for very long because they were very closed off, like authoritarian governments. And so I think that when you're kind of getting in the weeds here, but with Russia and the Ukraine, the United States doesn't really know what Vladimir Putin wants to do. But I think that they know Vladimir Putin doesn't necessarily want to get into war. But if the door were open, Russia would take Ukraine. So what Biden has to do is be able to deter Russia from invading Ukraine with the knowledge that Russia knows that the United States wouldn't actually fight them over Ukraine. So what other tools are available to Biden to deter Russia? Well, you posture and you put at least some doubt into the Russian minds, especially Vladimir Putin's mind, that if he does invade Ukraine, there is actually a military response. And you are seeing military buildup of NATO forces in surrounding countries around Ukraine. There are now forces in Estonia. And actually, even after 2015, when Russia annexed Crimea, which is in the Ukrainian border, the NATO forces had already, in response to that, there was already a response forces and a buildup of NATO assets around Ukraine. So the United States and NATO, its NATO allies, are bolstering an already decent foundation of forces in response to the Russian buildup on the Ukrainian border. So you have posturing, you also have the economic might of both the United States and its Western allies. So you can make war as costly as possible on Russia to where it's not worth it to them to invade Ukraine. And you can do that through trade embargoes, tariffs on Russian exported goods, which can cripple the Russian economy, which is already, with the coronavirus pandemic, already seeing the Russian economy is already in trouble, and it needs and it's looking for a remedy to that. And I think a lot of what Russian posturing is doing is because there's a lot of restlessness within the Russian populace, and I think that it's hard to get a consensus on Russian public opinion, but Russia's a large country, so it's hard to really boil it down into two camps. But it kind of splits between Russian nationalists who aren't happy with Putin because they want to see Russian return to its former glory under the Soviet Union as a global superpower. And then there are also people who want democratic reforms because they're unhappy with Putin essentially installing himself as a dictator. So I think that this kind of happens a lot in totalitarian regimes, is that when there's internal strife, you see sword rattling trying to drum up nationalist sentiment, and you create an external enemy to try to coalesce differing factions who are upset at you into more of a mindset of rallying around the flag, rallying around the nation, because there's this external threat. And anytime Russian oligarchs, any of the Russian dictator, like the Soviet dictators, needed to drum up public support, they always had a very ready, and just like the United States has done with Russia, anytime you need to shift focus away from political strife and political unrest, you point to the existential threat, the big bad guy on the other side, which for Russia is NATO, and for NATO and Western countries, it is Russia. So I think there's a lot of posturing there. So I don't know how serious Russia is even in terms of its invading Ukraine. But like I said, if Putin believes that the door is open enough to invade Ukraine, he would. But I think the United States has already shown that it's going to make it as expensive and as possible to a point where it's not economically feasible or worth it for Russia to do it. But I think the United States needs to, like, it needed to have this response, because if it allowed Ukraine to fall, one, that erodes the norm of sovereignty even more so than it already has been eroded, of nation-state sovereignty, which is a core principle of the post-World War II era, but also is that it's a kind of a domino effect, because, like I said in the earlier segments, there are other nations that are NATO members that we have a treaty obligation to defend on the Russian border. Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania are actually sitting between Russia, like in the sandwich between Russian territory. There's a small piece of Russian territory that is split between those, like split on the other side of those three countries. And if Russia was like, well, we got away with taking Ukraine, why don't we just completely reunite these areas with Russia, which were former Soviet Union satellite countries? And then all of a sudden, would we go to war with Russia over Estonia? We technically have a treaty obligation to do so, but would the American populace be okay with potential nuclear fallout or massive loss of U.S. life defending a small Eastern European country? Probably not. And I really don't think that's one of the arguments against NATO, like this broad NATO expansion to so many different nation states, is that what gives NATO its deterrence is its attack on one is an attack on all, Article 5, where it's collective defense. You will go to the defense of any attack on a nation, on a member state. So once that faith is eroded, NATO ceases to have its deterrent effect. And its deterrence is its major tool. It keeps us out of war. And being able to, we have to maintain the utmost semblance of deterrence abroad. Otherwise, NATO really, like I said, ceases to exist as an effective tool to keep war from happening. And I think at all costs, Biden, in his administration, his State Department, and his military advisors need to uphold the ability for the United States and its allies to deter Russian or Chinese or whomever our adversary is in a way that doesn't actually lead to bullets flying. And that is, I think, if we fail to do that, it is an utmost failure of foreign policy. And I think that what points to my argument that we're not going to go to war in Ukraine is that Estonia, which has a very vested interest of keeping Russia out of Ukraine, because Estonia would likely be next if Russia chose to keep expanding, went to go put actual boots on the ground. Germany vetoed that decision because the Article 5 component of this, if Estonian troops are killed in Ukraine, what does Estonia then do? And does that then cause a war between Estonia and Russia? And does that draw the rest of NATO into a war? So I think that that action itself kind of lifted the veil a bit on what NATO/United States' view of the situation is and what their actual intent would be should war break, like should Russia actually invade. But understanding the importance of maintaining a deterrence posture, which was one of the major fundamental issues I had with Trump's foreign policy and his really short-sighted transactional view. I remember specifically dealing with the former president and how he handled NATO, is he consistently called out NATO allies who were not at the 2% threshold. So the threshold being that if you're a member state of NATO, you have to have 2% of your GDP, your gross domestic product, how much money you make as a country, has to go to defense. And because that maintains a certain level of collective defense should NATO need to go to war. And there are several nation states that prior to 2020 were not at those levels. And he called that out and said, hey, you need to get up to 2%. Otherwise, I can't guarantee that America will be there should you should you need us, which I get having a problem with some countries bandwagoning on the collective defense, not paying their dues and but still wanting the benefits of being part of the organization. That's a valid complaint, but undermining the very foundation of NATO and the whole reasoning that NATO exists as a deterrent, which in the long run, the little like 5% of GDP that Estonia isn't or whomever isn't paying towards collective defense. Estonia actually is. It's been over the 2% for a long time. But complaining about that little 5% or like whatever half a percentage of one small country's GDP going to collective defense is such a short-sighted view of that, of the damage that he could have potentially done by saying, hey, by the biggest power broker, the biggest name, the face of NATO saying, well, we don't know if we'd be there for collective defense because you guys aren't paying your fair share. When actually NATO had already passed a resolution to make sure that all countries are at the 2% threshold by 2024. And then also in May of 2020, shortly after taking office, the former president questioned the admittance of North Macedonia into NATO, which is the 30th and most recent member, saying like, we wouldn't go to war. Why would we go to war with over somebody from North Macedonia? And that like in itself is such a, I mean, it's unveiling, I think, a truth. I don't think that he's necessarily wrong. Like I've already said, like, I don't think the United States would go to war with somebody over one of the small Baltic states who are a NATO member, but you don't say that out loud because the whole reason why war continues to not happen is because of collective defense and deterrence, maintaining that posture. And I think that is why war will not break out between the United States and Russia is because of the collective defense in NATO, and at all costs, the United States needs to uphold that. So I think with that, we're going to wrap up this episode. I'd like to thank you guys all for listening. I really do appreciate it. I think next month we will, I'm not quite sure what our topic's going to be, but it'll be interesting to see how this plays out over the next month, and we'll check back in then. So you've been listening to The Republic. I am Jake. We'll see you next month.
Big thank you to Craft Cannabis, formerly known as New Vansterdam, for supporting our radio community. Craft Cannabis now has two locations here in Vancouver. Both locations offer online ordering and curbside pickup. The Mill Plain location has an express window that serves as a contactless option to pick up your cannabis products. The newest shop is located on Andreessen Road, off Patton Parkway, next to the Home Depot, across from Costco. Both locations are open daily, 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. More information available at craftcannabis.com.